Okay, so the topic today is how to get your prayers answered every time.
Oh, okay.
In Jerusalem, there was this female American journalist, and she heard about this old rabbi that...
Hello. Oh.
So this American female journalist heard about this old rabbi who visited the Wailing Wall, the Kotel, to pray, to daven twice every day for a very long time. So in an effort to check out the story, she goes to the holy site, and there he is. And she watches the old man in prayer. And after about 45 minutes, when he gets up and turns to leave the Kotel, she approaches him for an interview, and she says, "Hello, my name is Rebecca Smith from CNN. Sir, how long have you been coming to the Wailing Wall and praying?" So the man says, "For about 50 years. She says, "That's amazing. What do you pray for?" So he says, "I pray for peace, peace between the Arabs and Israel. I pray for all the hatred to stop. I pray for all our children to grow up in safety and in friendship." And so the reporter says, "And how do you feel, sir, after doing this for 50 years? How do you feel?" And he says, "I feel like I'm talking to a brick wall."
Push it up and it'll hit you.
Prayer can be very challenging.
Yeah.
So, first of all, the fact that you guys are here at a class on how to pray effectively and how to get your prayers answered puts you in a very rare category of people. When you're sitting in shul next to the other people that are going to be there, you're going to be way ahead of them, because at least, so that's the first thing. So you're to be congratulated that for attending such a class, especially in the middle of a business day. The other thing is, just before I launch into the strategies on how to get our prayers answered, I just want to go back to a story everybody knows, the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And we know that in the Garden of Eden there was a snake, and the snake convinced Eve and then Adam to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, which they were not allowed. They were prohibited from eating from that tree of knowledge. And everybody got into trouble. I have to pay a mortgage. Other people... Adam had to work hard, toil by the sweat of his brow. That's how he earns his livelihood. Eve and all her descendants have the travails of childbirth, the difficulties of childbirth and raising children. And the snake also gets a punishment. So what was the snake's punishment? The snake's punishment is that he gets to eat dust. Not only as in you're going to eat dust, but literally. A snake eats dust. And in fact, any food that a snake eats tastes like dust to him. So there's no, they don't have taste buds, so it's all the same. So a snake cannot enjoy a Starbucks coffee. Do they have Starbucks over here?
Yeah, we do.
Unfortunately. They have it everywhere. So a snake cannot enjoy Starbucks coffee. He can only, because it will taste like dust to him. And that's his curse. But it doesn't really sound like such a bad curse, because in a sense, the snake can find its food everywhere. If it eats dust, and it actually can derive nutritional value from the dust, as our sages tell us, then it must be that it's living in an abundance, because there's a lot of dust around. No matter where you are in the world, there's a lot of dust. And you will always have Starbucks everywhere you go. Or dust bucks, whatever it's called in the snake world. So what's the curse? If I would say, "I'm cursing you that everywhere you turn, you will find sustenance." What kind of a curse is that? Every other, you know, human beings, all other people, we have to work for our sustenance. We have to pray and ask God for help and everything. But a snake has it easy. And that's a, you know... They say a dog's life. You say a snake's life. Snakes have it easy. And the answer the Baal Shem Tov gave, an explanation from the Baal Shem Tov, is that because the snake always has food readily available all around, it is not, the snake never has to pray to God, to ask God for anything. And that's the curse. The curse is that a snake never has to plead and pray to God. So what's the curse in that? The curse in that is that prayer is an opportunity to connect to a greater power. It's an opportunity to elevate yourself. And the snake is denied that opportunity. That's the curse. The curse is of abundance is that we never have to pray and ask God for that. And you want to, prayer is the language of the soul as it is connecting to a higher power. You know, you could be sitting next to a person, let's say in an airport. You're sitting next to this person and you strike up a conversation, and before long, you know, you're doing the Jewish geography thing, and then you ask him, tell me, what do you do for a living? And the guy says, oh, me, I'm a member of parliament. You go, what? You're a member of parliament? Oh, all of a sudden now, remember, okay, till now you were having a nice relationship. Now you really want to connect with this person because he's somebody in authority. That is human nature. We want to connect to somebody in authority. We want to connect to people who are higher than us. And prayer is that opportunity to connect to the ultimate high. So today, I want to share with you five secrets, a five-point strategy to getting all your prayers answered all the time. And it really, really works. And it's just five user-friendly steps that you can implement from Mincha this afternoon, from your afternoon prayers today. Okay. So the first step, the first secret. You ready for it? Fasten your seatbelts. The first secret is, it has nothing to do... The first step is not about prayer, actually. It's about God. Because unless you believe in a God who hears you, you cannot pray. I think I once mentioned to you the story of... I have a friend who's a professor of anatomy. And he took his child to see to help him set up his classroom one Sunday for a lecture that he was going to give on Monday. And his son, who was like 4 or 5 years old at the time, when he walked into the lecture room, he saw a fully articulated skeleton, human skeleton. And the professor was extremely concerned that he saw the terror on his son's face. And he was concerned that perhaps his son was would have nightmares and would be emotionally scarred from seeing this very, you know, frightening adult-sized skeleton, you know, looking down at this little kid. And his child looked very nervous. But then the child turned to his father, and he said to him, "Ta, tell me something. In our bodies, in human bodies, do we have screws holding our bones together?" It was good. His father's a professor of anatomy in McGill Medical School, so he asked the right guy. I think there's few people in the world more qualified to answer that question. And correct me if I'm wrong, Doc, but we do not have screws holding our... We do not have screws holding us together, so... the father answered, "No, we don't have." Yes, that's true. Yes,
that's a good point.
Yeah, my mother has a screw in her hip. That's true. So Professor Brower says, "No, of course not. We don't have screws holding our bones together." So he says, "Aha." So then, but I have toys that have screws holding it together. Then he says, "Ta, are bones made of the same material, the same stuff that my Lego pieces are made, like plastic, you know? Are they made of plastic like my Lego?" And the father says, "No, they're not made of plastic." So the son says, "Uh-huh, okay, this is not real. It's a toy. It has screws like my toys have screws. It has plastic like my toys have plastic. It's not real. It's not real." And so he reduced this frightening skeleton into a little toy, and then went around playing. All of his arguments were actually logically consistent. very well thought out argument, especially for a 4-year-old, and he had reduced this skeleton to being nothing more than a toy, and it was no longer frightening. Sometimes we reduce God, for whatever reason, in our heads, into something like a toy. And then it is no longer something you can take seriously. So the first step is that you have to believe in God. I mean, if you're going to pray to somebody, you have to believe that that being is there and that he's capable of responding to your requests that you're going to offer him in prayer. Reminds me of these two boys who lived with their grandmother, and they're about to go to bed, to sleep one night. And the older son started to pray, and he prayed, he asked God for forgiveness. There's a special prayer that we say when we go to sleep at night. It's called Kriya Shema Shalamita, the reading of the Shema at the bedside. And he prayed to God, you know, forgive me for everything I've done, and he said the Shema and all those things. So then the youngest brother also started praying, and he prayed much louder than his older brother. And he said, "Dear God, I want bikes, and I want toys, and I want all these things," and, you know, gives his whole shopping list. So when he finished, his older brother said, "Why are you praying so loud? God isn't deaf." The younger brother responds, "Yes, God isn't deaf, but grandmother is." So what you need to realize is that God is not deaf. You don't have to shout. He can hear you. It's interesting. I give I think I mentioned once, every second week in my house, I give there's an event for people who are in their 20s, their late teens and 20s. And this group, they come, and they're all Mount Scopus graduates and King David. You know, they've gone through the Jewish system, the Jewish school, and they're members of, by and large, members of our congregation. Some are friends of members of our congregation. And they come to my house every second week, and we have something called Kabbalah and chicken soup. And what this is my wife makes, it started off as one pot of chicken soup, and we're now up to two pots of chicken soup as this thing is growing. And they come, and we drink the chicken soup, make sure they come back again every week. But the talk is we speak about lots of mystical things and so on. But what was interesting for me is that the first, and they're all like university age or recent graduates from university, and the first one we had, I quickly went around the table and I said, please be honest with me. I want to know who here believes in God. You know, do you believe in God? And I turned to the first one and she says no. And I turned to the next one and he says no, 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 no. And unanimously, none of them believed in God. So I said, first of all, thank you for your honesty. And second of all, boy, am I relieved. Because if I would think God is what you think he is, I also wouldn't believe in him. Because if you think of God in terms of this old man with a long white beard that when he snores it thunders, and, you know, you have a very simplistic childlike view of God, then hopefully you don't believe that that's God, because God is much bigger than that. You know, when the Tanya was first published, the Tanya is the chief book of Chabad Hasidism, written by the Alter Rebbe. And when it was published, they tell a story that Reb Levi Yitzchak of Baditchev was given a copy of the book, a manuscript, to write an approbation, an approval of the book, which is very important in religious books. It's very important that you get prominent rabbis to approve that it is, like a kosher stamp on food. So this is a kosher stamp on the content of the book. So they gave it to Reb Levi Yitzchak Baditchev. He sat down, he started learning the Tanya, and then the story goes that he ran through the streets crying, holding the Tanya, and proclaiming in the streets, "Such a great big God contained in such a small book." He was so impressed. He said, "It's amazing how we got such a big God into such a small book." And of course, the Tanya makes God bigger than what we ever thought he was. And the Tanya is physically actually not a very large book. It's quite a a modest book in terms of its size and displacement. So I told them, look, you know, we have to go through the Tanya. We have to understand God in a more sophisticated way, because this is the problem. You see, in year one, everybody had a teacher, Mrs. Smith, right? So we all have Mrs. Smith, and Mrs. Smith taught us two things. The first thing she taught us is that 1 + 1 = 2. And the next thing she taught us is that there's a God who created the world in 7 days. In 6 days, the seventh, he rested. Now, that was all good for somebody in first grade. You know, for a six-year-old, that's all fine and dandy. The problem is that 1 + 1 got more sophisticated. It became multiplication, algebra, that's where I lost it, and then it became trigonometry and geometry, and you know, you could continue and go to university and learn applied mathematics or theoretical mathematics or whatever, and you could become a professor. There's no end to it, right? And it just gets more and more sophisticated, more developed and everything. I mean, it's still the basic fundamental building blocks are there. It's arithmetic. 1 + 1 still equals 2. But it's become a much more advanced system of thinking. The problem is, though, that God didn't advance. God remains stuck as this, you know, man with this long beard, who when he snores, it thunders, and when he cries, it rains. And that is this childlike, simplistic view that many people got stuck with, and that never progressed. So nobody ever learned more about that. Nobody ever studied Jewish, you know, mysticism from that point on to develop that point further. So, therefore, the first step is really to try and understand and learn and expose yourself as much as possible to who God is. You know, meet God and understand Him. And here I'm going to do a shameless plug for my book, which is going to, hopefully, please God, be published in the very near future, although we don't have a definite date yet. And it's called It Isn't Easy Being God, The Unauthorized Biography. So, and it's a book about God. So get a book, get hold of that book, you know, buy many copies, and, you know, read them all, give them to your friends, and learn who God is. And that's who you're addressing in prayer. So that's the first step. A lot of people miss that point, but it's quite important.
And how do you do it?
You learn. You learn about...
Or reading your book.
You read my book, you buy my book, you buy many copies.
By next week.
Huh?
It's not ready yet.
My book is not ready yet, this is true. I mean, you could read the manuscript if you want, but... no, it's... to be serious, like to study, to find... you know, the Tanya, which I've mentioned before, but there are other books and that speak about God. Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, is a systematic study of God and how He relates to this world and how He created this world. So study that. There's a good, very good start. Keep coming to these classes. You know, this is... But get to know God. All right, the second step, the second secret is to take ownership of your destiny. And that is, you know, prayer is not a spectator sport. It's not something that you just watch other people do. You have to take responsibility for your own destiny and your own life. So there was a poem somebody sent me last week or the week before, and I thought it's a very interesting poem. It's called There's a Hole in My Sidewalk. And I'll read you the poem. So this is chapter one. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Chapter two. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place. But it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down another street. The end.
It's a good book.
Hmm?
Good story.
It's fantastic. I love it. Because what it's saying is, to me, I mean, there's lots of meaning here, and every time I read it, I see something new. But I think what it's saying is that, well, on one level, that we are not victims of what's happening around us. So the first thing is we have to understand that prayer will work, and we do need to do things that are going to improve our lot in life and provide us with the protection and the nourishment and all the things that we need as human beings. So, you know, in my synagogue, both the one that I was in Canada and my current synagogue here in Australia, there are normally two representatives who pray for us, for our congregations, and that is the rabbi and the cantor, the rabbi and the chazan. And everyone basically sits in their seats and they watch the show. They observe the rabbi gives a sermon, and for 5 minutes everybody's really inspired, hopefully, if it's a half-decent rabbi, sometimes not. Sometimes they get a good 5 minutes sleep, but even so, the chazan certainly sings a beautiful melody, everybody's happy. And what you're doing is you're relying on the rabbi, on the cantor, the choir, if you have, to stimulate you, to inspire you, and to get you going on the prayer thing. But the thing is, I want to say, don't depend on somebody else to do your praying for you. Like we don't depend on somebody else to do our eating for us, we shouldn't depend on other people to do our praying for us. We shouldn't designate prayer professionals. We should, you know, somebody once said, his philosophy vis-a-vis me as a rabbi in the shul is, he says, we pay, you pray, right? But Judaism is not like that. Judaism is not a spectator sport. We've got to participate. So that this is the second idea, that you've got to participate. It's interesting that on one Rosh Hashanah night in Europe, the Cossacks captured the rabbi, the cantor, and the president of a synagogue. And they granted them one final wish before they were going to put them to death on Rosh Hashanah. So the rabbi said, all year round, I prepare my Rosh Hashanah sermon. Really, the whole year I'm thinking about it and working on it and polishing it and preparing it. You cannot kill me before you let me present my sermon and get it out of my system. Okay, the Cossacks tell him, we'll allow you to give the sermon. Now they turn to the chazan, the cantor, and they say, how about you? What's your final wish? And the chazan says, for 364 days a year, I prepare my cantorial presentations for the high holidays. I arrange the music. And this year, I composed many new, brilliant, extraordinary compositions. You have to let me sing them before you kill me. Granted, said the Cossacks. Then they turn to the president and they say, and you? What about you? And the president says, you know, what's your final wish? And the president says, my final wish is that you kill me first. The Baal Shem Tov once said that a story, an allegorical story, a very interesting story. He said that one time, fascinating story this, one time the lion grew furious with all the other jungle animals. Now the lion is the king of the animals, and he's the most powerful and the most dominant animal, and when his ire is evoked, everybody trembles. All the other animals, their hearts tremble. So what should they do? They have an emergency session, they appoint a committee, they're deciding, they're debating, they're deliberating. They don't know what to do. If the lion lets out his anger, they say, we are finished. No worries, says one of the fox, one of the animals, the fox. He is the cleverest of all the animals, right? The wiliest of all the animals. The fox says, no problem. In the reservoirs, says the fox, of my great brain, there are 300 jokes. 300 jokes. Stories. Funny, humorous stories. I will present these 300 stories to the lion. He will laugh so much that his mood will instantly change. So a wave of joy rushes through everybody. They're all excited. They're, oh, finally, we're going to be saved. And they all embark on a march towards the lion. The lion's home, his den. And the fox is walking with them. The fox will placate the lion because he knows all these funny stories and he's going to make the lion happy. During the journey through the pathways of the jungle, the fox suddenly turns to one of his animal friends and he says, you know, I forgot 100 of my entertaining stories. 100 entertaining stories, I just forgot them. So rumors of the fox's lapse of memory rush throughout all the animals and they're all like, memory, what's happening over here? But some animals are just, you know, totally overcome with trepidation and fear and this is crazy. Forgot 100. But soon, the voice of the bear was heard. What did the bear say? Mr. Bear says, don't worry. 200 anecdotes, 200 stories, 200 jokes from a brilliant fox are more than enough to get an arrogant lion rolling in laughter and delight. It's fine, we'll go with 200 stories. A little while later, as the large entourage of animals is getting closer to the lion, the Mr. Fox suddenly turns to another colleague and he says, you know what, I've forgotten another 100 stories. They've just clean forgot. They simply slipped my mind. So now the animals are even more fearful. What's going to happen? But again, Mr. Deer, the voice of reason, don't worry. 100 fox stories are enough to capture the imagination of a simple lion king. It's going to be fine. A few moments later, all of the hundreds and thousands of animals are standing at the lion's den. The lion rises to his full might and glory and height. He casts a fierce gaze at all these subjects and sends a shiver up everybody's spine. And the moment of truth has arrived. All the animals looked with beseeching eyes to the fox, their representative, to approach the lion, accomplish his mission. At that moment, the fox turns to the animals and he says, my dear friends, I am so sorry. I forgot the last 100 stories. I have nothing left to say to the king. So the animals go into an hysteria. They say, you're a vicious liar. You deceived us completely. What are we to do now? So the fox says calmly, listen, my job was to persuade you to take the journey from your nest and come here to the lion's den. I've accomplished my mission. You are here now. Now, each and every single one of you needs to discover your own voice and rehabilitate your own relationship with the Lion King. That's not my function to do. And the Baal Shem Tov concluded this story by saying that illustrates a common problem with institutional religion. And that is, people come to the synagogues on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, which is just over a month away, or any other time of year, it doesn't matter. And they come over there and they rely on the foxes, the cantors, the rabbis, to do the praying for them, but to represent them to the King of Kings. People say, you know, rabbi's sermon, unbelievable today. Or the cantor is vibrato, just melted my soul. And they have all these, you know. But the clergy, their function, as I see it, is just to be foxes, to get the people to the shuls. Once the people are in the shuls, then they need to really reach out to God without any intermediary and directly. So sooner or later, everyone's going to have to talk to the king themselves, and the foxes are going to forget their stories, and that's what's going to happen. So the second step is, it's not a spectator sport. You've got to do it yourself. Davening is a process. It's not an easy process. It's a challenging one. It's one that you have to work at. You know, Olympic athletes don't just show up at the Olympic Games. They have a training session before. And similarly, you can't just show up Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and be an elite praying athlete. You've got to build it up. It's a very difficult process, but a very rewarding process. So now I come to the third secret, the third step, and that is pray like you expect results. They tell this story about these three farmers during a period of drought who's standing out in a field and they're praying for rain. And a man comes along and he asks them what they're doing. So they say, we're praying for rain. So the man says, nah, I don't think so. So the first farmer is insulted. He says, what? Don't you see? We're on our knees. We're begging God. What do you mean? Nah, you don't think so. Look at us. Yes, the second farmer says, we're putting our hearts into it. And then the third farmer chimes in and he says, yeah, we're not asking for ourselves. We're asking for our families, for our communities. So the man says, hogwash. You're wasting your time. So they say, why do you say that? And he says, because to get your prayers answered, you have to believe that they're going to be answered. And you guys don't believe that they're going to be answered. And they all say, but we do. And the man says, not really. If you did, you would have brought an umbrella. I'm not sure if I told you the story of this woman who called up a wedding hall, and she booked the wedding hall on June the 11th last year, a year ago. Not this June, but the June before. She booked her hall. She went and got fitted for her dress.
She didn't have a groom.
She did everything. She went, she got the caterers, everything at the band. She didn't have a groom. That's right. She did not have a groom.
No, it makes sense. It makes total sense. That's what you do.
She didn't have a groom, but she had everything else. She got onto Oprah, and Oprah interviewed her. She spoke to Oprah, so it was quite a famous thing. She said, I'm manifesting this. This is,
that's right.
That husband is going to walk down the aisle with me on June 11th, 2010, whenever it was. And that's it. That's what's going to happen. And they followed her, and as did I, because I was pretty intrigued. And needless to say, about 1 year after she had made all the arrangements, she walked down the aisle, and she is happily married to her husband, who appeared somewhere in the middle of that year as her boyfriend, and then proposed to her, and she said, well, I actually have everything in place. I've done all arrangements. You just got to show up.
And he stayed with her after she said that.
Yeah, well, he probably knew.
Going on Oprah, right?
Well, she was on Oprah, yeah. So I think some people watched Oprah when it used to be around. So you have to, that's how you have to pray. You know, if you have a father
Oprah
who...
helps.
What's that?
Oprah helps.
Oprah helps, yeah, that does help. If you pray, if you have a father and he's putting you through a very expensive university and he's paying your fees and your maintenance and everything, and you need to borrow a quarter... Do they have such a thing here? You need to borrow... No, they don't have... You need to borrow a dollar for something. Something small. You need a quick dollar. And you go to him and you say, Dad, could you do me a big favor? I need a dollar. Is there any expectation that the father would say no? A father who's giving $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year to educate his child, and the child asks for a legitimate reason, you know, for something... Let's say the father says, could you please go and get me something? You say, okay, I'll need a dollar. Do you have a dollar on you? Yeah. No. There is no expectation amongst that child that the father is not going to say, sure, here's the dollar. No expectation. It's obvious. Obviously, you're going to ask him. He gives you so much. And he has, let's say he's a wealthy father. He has that. He's going to give you that dollar. There's just no question about it. Well, God is much wealthier than that father. And much more interested in giving you the dollar, and gives you much more because it gives you everything, your life, your sustenance, everything. So you ask him for a thing, you have to have an expectation that he's going to say yes. You've got to have that expectation. So whenever you start and ask God for something, you've got to go in with that expectation. So step number four is, don't sabotage your prayer. What do I mean by sabotage? Sometimes, okay, I believe that every thing that at the core of our personalities, every human being has a core fear, and the flip side of that core fear, a core desire, that almost every major decision that you make is filtered through that desire and that fear. So let's say that somebody's core fear would be to be alone. Let's say somebody was very afraid of being alone. Lonely. Then the flip side of that would be their core desire would be to have as many friends as possible. And so they're going to make decisions and be motivated to surround themselves and to establish as many relationships as possible so that they'll never be alone. Or if somebody's core desire is to earn money, so that then his core fear would be that he doesn't want to be perceived as a failure or whatever. Everyone has their own at the core of their personality. Very hard to see what it is. You often need somebody else to help you see what your core desire is and what your core fear is. But my experience is that you can reduce any person down to a core desire and a core fear. Now, they're the flip side of each other. So they always come together. So when you're going to ask God for something, that's the desire. You want him to fulfill that desire. You're always going to have, coming with that, the fear. Now, let me ask you energetically, what's a more powerful, in general, what's more powerful? Desire or fear?
Fear.
Fear is more. So this is what a prayer probably sounds like if you're the angel that's supposed to take the prayers to God, right? So this is something what it sounds like. God, please give me money. Make me able to, you know, pay the school fees this month. Right? That's fine.
It's a big ask.
It's a very big ask. In here in Australia, forget about it. So God, you know, let me cover the school fees just this month. Let me cover the school fees, right? And then right with that, a much more louder, much more thing is coming. I am a failure. I am not supporting my family. I am not looking after my things. Now, both those messages are going to attract a response. And the response is going to be equal to what you're putting out there. And since fear is a much stronger energy than desire in general, unless we collapse it, but if it's left unchecked, it generally is a much stronger, it's a much stronger energy that puts out a stronger, it's going to attract a much more powerful response. So here's our problem. Our problem is when we pray, we don't go like to that Father, like I said in the last step, and expect that it's absolutely like it's already done. We don't live as if. We don't go and book the hall. You know, there was a group, two couples that came to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and they asked him, they were both had been married for a significant period of time, and they had not been blessed with children. And the Rebbe gave both of them a blessing. 1 year later, the one couple had was celebrating the bris of their son, and the other couple still had not conceived. So the couple that had not conceived went back to the Rebbe and asked him, how come they asked around the same time, and they were blessed with children, and we still not? And the Rebbe said, because when they came, I gave them a blessing, I gave you a blessing. When I gave them a blessing, they walked out of my office, and the next day, they went to the store and they bought a pusher and they bought a cot and they bought a changing table because they were going to have a baby and they needed these things. So they acted as if they already had the blessing and they went out and they did it. You didn't. You know, in Yiddish, there's a saying, tracht gut vet sein gut, which means if you think positive thoughts, it creates a positive reality. When you think something good, it creates the reality becomes good. If you think something bad, you create that reality too. I mean, the flip side of it is true also. So if you're thinking something positive, if you're saying, God, you can, you can support me financially, emotionally, whatever people ask for in terms of my health, that you can heal me. And you go to God and you say, you can heal me, I know you can. Like, I know that my father would give me a dollar or 10 cents because he gives me so much. I know absolutely, I have no question that you're going to answer. And that's the attitude that you approach, and there's no fear there, and you've collapsed your fear. It's not, there's not an underlying message of fear there. And you come to God like that, he will always, then you've learned the lesson that you need to learn. You've connected to God in the ways that you need to connect to him. And there's no reason to withhold that. God does not, by default, withhold anything from us. We get everything we need. If he's withholding it from us, then it's because we need to grow in certain ways, and sometimes through the struggle, we grow in those ways. So even that is God's compassion, that he's making us struggle, and that things are difficult for us. That itself is part of God's compassion. What is prayer? Prayer, when you come with the right attitude, is saying to God, I got it. I got the message. I've learned what you need. I learned that I need to rely on you. I learned that message, that I'm not independent and I'm not able to do anything I want. I learned that. Thank you, God. Thank you for teaching me that. I got it. So now I got it. You can take away the suffering because I got the lesson. That's what prayer is about. Prayer is a meditative process where you're saying, where you're internalizing the lessons of life and using them as a catalyst to connect to God in a much deeper, more profound way. So the fourth is, don't sabotage your prayer. Don't contradict your prayers with fears that are more powerful than the good intentions that you're throwing out there. And then I will just conclude with the fifth and final one. Do we have enough time? Yeah, see, I spoke quickly. Yeah, so the fifth is, it's God's way, not our way. And what I mean by that is that since I said that prayer, it's interesting, if you want to know anything, like if you want to really understand a concept, I find it very useful to look at the Hebrew word for a concept, because Hebrew is a magnificent language in the way that there's so many layers of meaning in everything. So what's the Hebrew word for prayer?
Tefillah.
Tefillah. That's the Hebrew word for prayer. But tefillah also comes from the word tofel, which means to sew or to connect, to sew together or to connect two things that are separate. Because that's what prayer is. It's connecting us to God in communication, in a communication. But communication is a two-way street. I talk to you, you talk back to me. If I'm just talking to you, then that's a lunch lecture. That's not a communication. So it's the same with our connection to God. You can pray for whatever you want at any time in the day. That's what Maimonides says is the class is the essential definition of the mitzvah, the commandment to pray, is that whenever, at any time of any day, you need something, you realize that you're relying on God for that thing, so you ask Him for that thing. That is the definition of prayer. You know, let's say that a person was driving down a winding road on a mountain, and it was late at night, and it was raining. I could really set the scene here. And the person's driving, and it's a really dangerous road, and it's very high up in the mountains, and right on the side there's a huge cliff and drop. And as the person comes around a corner, there's a big truck with its headlights on. And it's going head first into this, into the car that this person's driving. So the person swerves, goes off the road, over the side of the road, and you know, time slows down, and they're going like, "Help, please God, save me," you know, and how these things happen. And all of a sudden, the car lands gently on some tree or something that's growing out of the side of the mountain, and the person's safe. Mm-hmm. So what does the person say? They say, "Thank God, thank God, thank God, thank God," right? Baruch Hashem, wow, sweet, you know? That's it. I'm going to shul. I'm going to make a blessing. That's amazing, right? Person's very, very excited about that. Now, let me ask you this question. Who pushed the guy off the road in the first place?
God.
That is the obvious but alarming answer. It was God who pushed him off in the first place. You know, I had a lady, a congregant of mine, who was vacuuming her home, and she fell. She tripped, an older lady. She tripped, and she fell and broke her ribs, which is why I don't do the vacuuming, by the way. That's very dangerous. But anyway, she did the vacuuming, and she tripped and she fell and she hurt her ribs, and they rushed her to the emergency, and there's really not much you can do for cracked ribs. But they gave her an x-ray, and the doctor who was looking at the x-ray in the emergency didn't like something he saw on the x-ray, so he commissioned a CAT scan?
Yeah, CT.
Huh? CT?
CT.
He commissioned a CT, and they found a growth on her lung, which, thank God, was very early stages, and they were able to remove the growth, and she had a small operation done and recovered fully. She was totally asymptomatic. She did not have any symptoms prior to that. And so therefore, what was really a very tragic thing, that she had injured herself and she had cracked some ribs, actually turned out to save her life. Now, obviously, if I were God, I would have scripted things a little bit differently. I would have just made her, not given her the growth of the tumor in the first place, right? I mean, why go through that whole thing and everything? But, you know, obviously I'm not God. And the point is that he does things his way, not necessarily our way. And sometimes we have a certain plan of how we want our life to look, but God has a better plan always. And so that's the fifth secret, to really understand that God answers every prayer. Sometimes the answer is no, but God does answer every prayer. And everything that he does for us, whether we recognize it or not, and mostly it's not so simple to see, is done for our optimal good. And that's the fifth step. So I'll just quickly summarize the steps. Look at my notes again to remember it. The first is that prayer is not a spectator sport. You've got to participate. It takes practice. You can't just be a professional prayer person off the bat. You've got to practice. You've got to start with smaller prayer services. I used to tell people to come to shul just 15 minutes before the kiddush, before the before the kiddush, to come and spend just 15 minutes at the end of the prayer service, then the next week come half an hour before and slowly break yourself into that systematic and organized prayer service. The other thing is that you do control your own destiny. You have to understand that, that God set things up in a way that we can run things, so to speak, by not being a victim, not falling into the hole in the sidewalk constantly, but making sure that we avoid that. And the third is to pray like you expect results, not to allow your... The fourth is not to sabotage your prayer by allowing your fears and so on to get involved. And the fifth is that it's God's way or the highway. All right. I saw some people were really praying that I should end, so I will answer you, grant you your request, and end. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to take them. Wow. That's good. So everybody then agrees with everything I've said. Okay, we'll see you in synagogue this Shabbat morning.
Not in yours.
Oh well.
So nice.
I could try. Which other rabbi this week spoke to you about prayers? Don't all speak at once. All right. Okay, we did cover most of the ground that I wanted to, a lot quicker than I did. So next week, I believe that our topic is...
Are we continuing the topic of evolution of our own?
Yeah, we're just taking a little hiatus because it's coming up Rosh Hashanah. Next week is tshuva, which means repentance, in three easy jokes. I kid you not. I don't always make up these titles, by the way. I won't tell you about that one. Alright, so hopefully we'll see everybody next week. And
you'll have to tell me three jokes early because I'll be in New Zealand next week, so.
I'm sure it'll be podcast, and you can catch up on the podcast for pleasure. The podcasts are free, you can download them. It's just like prayers. You connect, and they instantly download all that information. All right, don't forget to bench, everybody.
Thank you.